Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 16th of March. The first hour of our program today, we talk about the nuclear crisis. Not that they just have a nuclear crisis. They have all kinds of crises in Japan. We've all been following this story very carefully, and we have two guests with us this hour to explain how much we know about the situation, and we'll also get a better understanding of what's happening scientifically with these nuclear reactors. You probably heard at the top of the news that the second reactor containment may have cracked, which keeps workers from doing their job, hampering efforts to cool those reactors, which is absolutely mandatory. The Emperor of Japan, Akihito, in a television address to the country, said that he was deeply worried about the ongoing nuclear crisis at several stricken reactors and asked for people to act with compassion to overcome these difficult times. There has been action by neighboring countries. China on Wednesday suspended approval for all nuclear power plants, even those that are in very preliminary stages. As you know, various nations across East Asia have said that they would step up inspection of food imported for Japan, with a worry that the radiation has gone into the farm fields and damaged crops and animals that eat food from those fields. And, of course, there have been rescue efforts from many nations around the world. There have been other countries who are doing serious inspections of particularly older nuclear power plants in their countries. And we will, of course, talk about whether or not that should be done here in the United States. We have two guests with us. Thomas Mao is a science medical writer for the Los Angeles Times. He has a PhD in chemistry and spent 13 years at Science Magazine and 26 years at the Los Angeles Times. Later, we will be speaking with the senior scientist of the nuclear program, Lands and Wildlife Program for the Natural Resources Defense Council. And I think we'll have a lot of phone calls on this, a lot of questions and concerns. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. In an ongoing attempt to try to find some common ground for the state of Wisconsin, we will have a Democratic state senator with us the second hour of the program, and we will have a Republican legislator, a representative with us. John Erpenbach will join us, and Gary Bies will join us. Gary is a Republican state representative from Sister Bay. And one of the questions we'll ask them is about nuclear power plants in the state of Wisconsin, and if they both are assured that they are completely safe, or do, at the very least, does somebody need to go and do more than one somebody, a complete inspection of those facilities. Here's our phone number for you to join the conversation, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Thomas, thank you very much for joining us.
Good morning.
Yeah, nice to have you here. I have heard and read a lot of the coverage of this. There are some who are saying that the information is forthcoming from the Japanese government on a fairly regular basis. There are other reporters who are there even who are saying that they're not getting the kind of information that they need to have. Is this because this is an unprecedented event, or are the Japanese holding some information close to their chest for whatever reason? I guess the question is, do we know moment by moment what is happening?
I suspect it's a little bit of both. I mean, they keep telling us, you know, there have been increases in radiation levels, but they don't give really hard numbers for how much that radiation has been. So, you know, we can only speculate to a certain extent how much radiation has been released. They've been keeping things pretty close to their chest. The Japanese government has been very heavily criticized in the past about not releasing information from previous nuclear accidents. So my understanding is they're being better now than they have been at those previous problems, but still not as good as we might hope.
Yeah. We read reports that to keep these reactors cool, we're depending on 50 people who were there who need to get seawater in or whatever they can do to cool these reactors. They have to leave every now and then because of explosions that take place with high levels of release of radioactivity. Does all of this really depend on those people who are really risking their lives to do this?
Yes.
It is. Oh, my gosh.
And I suspect those people are, for all practical purposes, dooming themselves to either cancer or worse in the future. If they walk away, I mean, it was really frightening news last night when they said they had to pull those people out of there. Because if that had happened and they had stopped cooling, then we really, God knows what would have happened at the site. All of those reactors would have probably gone into meltdown mode, and we would have had a major disaster. So, yeah, that is a small handful of people there who are standing between us and a major disaster.
Mm. And then we heard news this morning that the second reactor containment area may have cracked, which really keeps those workers from doing their job. A couple questions here is that happened yesterday and it's happening again today. And do they have a job that they can do that is successful? Because we're also hearing that it's difficult to get the seawater into those cooling areas to prevent that catastrophe.
Well, they keep saying that it's cracked, but, you know, I suspect that it's still a fairly minor crack. Judging from the amount of radiation that's coming out, it almost has to be a relatively minor crack. If it were a major breach of the containment vessel, we would be seeing fairly large quantities of radiation coming out of there, and I think they would, in fact, be abandoning the site. So I think it's still a fairly small crack.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's still hope. But as long as they can keep water in there, I think they can keep the situation at least contained.
And from some of the reports I was seeing last night, they're having difficulty getting some of the water in there, that seawater is being used, but they're having problems having enough helicopters or whatever they're using to get the water in there. Is that true, or are they...
Well, it is very hot. There's a lot of steam. They can't get close to it. They're trying to pump water into what is basically a closed vessel that has a lot of steam in it, so it's high pressure. So you're pumping water against that pressure. And at one point, the pressure was so high that they couldn't get the water into it at all, which is why the fuel rods were exposed to air in the first place. So that there's been a variety of reasons why they've been having problems getting the water in.
Mm-hmm. But
and there's another problem, not only the reactor, but they have the spent fuel pools on the roofs of the buildings that are also boiling, and they need to cool those as well. Those fuel pools have lost their cooling capacity, and one of the fuel pools was where the fire was for 2 days, and they're very concerned about that, and they're having a hard time figuring out how to get water to that. They were contemplating using helicopters to drop water on that, but they have decided that that might be too dangerous, so they haven't done that yet.
Mm-hmm. And is this a situation that you just have to watch, and for how long, to make sure that the worst has been kept from happening?
Well, the good news is that, let me back up a minute. When you shut down an operating reactor, even though it stops generating electricity, it's still producing a lot of heat. In a week or so, the amount of heat that reactor produces goes down by about 50%. So those reactors aren't producing nearly as much heat as they were when we shut them down last Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, the cooling effort is not as bad as it was last week. So we're getting some help there from just the normal cooling off of the reactors themselves. So things are getting better in that sense, and it's not quite as hard to cool them down. In another week, we should be approaching what's called a cold shutdown, where a minimal amount of cooling is all that's required to keep them cool. And the same is true, basically, for the spent fuel pools.
Really?
They put out heat, but not nearly as much as a reactor that's just been shut down. So as long as you can keep water in them, they should be fine.
So you're saying that a catastrophe can be avoided if this can be kept cool for the next week?
Yes.
And do you think that that is a likelihood? Is that because of all the aid that's going there and all the scientific minds who must be working on this?
I certainly hope so. I mean, right. I think it's a good possibility, yes. You know, it really depends on how badly that reactor vessel is cracked.
And why wouldn't we know that now? What's keeping us from knowing how badly it's cracked?
I don't think they can get in close enough to examine it.
I think
that's the real problem.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they keep talking about the fuel rods being melted, but they have no way of examining them physically to tell. So all they're doing is, you know, judging by how much radioisotopes they see escaping in the environment, they're kind of guesstimating what might have happened to the fuel rods. But they have no way of physically examining them to see what's happened to them, and they won't for weeks or months or even maybe years, depending on what happens at the site. So it's all a process of guesswork.
Right. And tell me about the levels of radiation that have been spread to farm fields in the area. We were hearing reports yesterday that this might be a source of concern, the food supply, at least in that part of Japan, because it may be contaminated.
Well, frankly, I think those levels are very small, and I don't think that's anything to be concerned about yet. The levels that have gone out so far are levels that, you know, you can wash off clothes, wash off your skin. I don't think it's anything to be concerned about yet. The people we really need to be concerned about are the workers at the plant. Beyond that, I think there's really no urgency to anybody else, you know, being in danger.
Mm-hmm. And are they in imminent danger? Can they?
The workers at the plant?
Yes.
Yes, I think they are. They've been exposed to a lot of radiation,
which could hurt them pretty quickly.
I would guess yes, but I don't know because they haven't really given good data. I think they're getting a lot of exposure. You have to keep in mind that they're wearing full protective gear there, and they're working in shifts, so they're not exposed for more than an hour or two at a time. But I would guess they're still getting a pretty heavy dose of radiation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're calling these people heroes.
And, yes.
And I think that's an understatement. I think they really are. They're going in there and they're risking their lives to prevent something very serious happening. So I think they're putting their lives on the line, and I think they may pay a very heavy price for it.
Yeah. It just gives you shivers, doesn't it? The whole story just gives you shivers. There have been responses in Europe, China saying today that they have suspended approval for all nuclear power plants, even those that are in the preliminary stages. Is this an overreaction or not?
Well, there are a couple things you got to keep in mind. A, these plants were 40 years old. These are among the first generation of plants that were installed. They came through the earthquake itself very well. They shut down properly. They did everything they were supposed to. The problem was the tsunami. The tsunami knocked out the backup power supply for the cooling. And, you know, so if this plant had been in Kansas or, you know, somewhere in the Midwest or somewhere away from the ocean shore, there would not have been a problem.
Mm-hmm.
It was the tsunami that did the damage. And you know, I have to wonder why they didn't plan on a tsunami that would damage the diesel generators there. That's something that people will have to be talking about after this whole episode is over. But beyond that, you know, I think that things are still pretty safe. And, you know, another thing to keep in mind is that most modern facilities are designed so that they have passive cooling. They don't need emergency generators to power the cooling. The cooling is designed so that it circulates on the basis of heat flow, just natural heat flow. The water circulates on its own. so that even if the diesel cooling shuts down, the water keeps flowing.
And so this would be the arrangement of nuclear power plants since when?
I don't know exactly when they started it, but probably in the last 20 years or so.
And do you think they, I don't know the history of tsunamis, did they not think about the possibility of a tsunami because we didn't have as many 40 years ago?
Well, I think they should have, yeah. I mean, they knew about tsunamis. I don't know why they didn't realize that a plant on the coast was vulnerable to a tsunami. I don't think they realized a quake this severe was coming. And, you know, the tsunami this severe was associated with a quake this severe. I think everything was just much bigger than they had planned for.
Yes. Let's welcome phone calls for you. Our guest the first half hour of the show is Thomas Mao. He's a science medical writer for the Los Angeles Times, where he has worked for the past 26 years. He does have a Ph.D. in chemistry from UC Santa Barbara, and he is... spent 13 years at Science Magazine as well. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we start our phone calls with Jeff in La Crosse. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Many years ago in college, in a class, I forget which one it was, the instructor had mentioned that there was a nuclear power plant in California located smack dab on the San Andreas fault line, and how strange that was and what could be the reason for that. And we just all wondered, and that's where it ended up at.
Thomas?
The San Onofre power plant on the coast is 5 miles from a fault line. It's not the San Andreas fault line. It's a different fault line, though.
Is there an attempt, and should there be an attempt, considering the fact that California is, so many people have said, long overdue for a major earthquake, should people be running to those nuclear facilities and making darn sure that they have thought of absolutely everything?
Well, that has been happening as far as I can tell. I mean, the authorities have been looking at them very carefully for years. Every time there's any earthquake anywhere, people go, you know, talk to the nuclear the power companies and ask about this. So I think that has been done as much as is humanly possible.
Mm-hmm. And what about older power plants? Do you have those in California, 40 years old? Are there power plants?
No, we only have 4 power plants in California. There's two reactors at San Onofre, and there's 2 at Diablo Canyon further up the coast. Those are the only 4 in California.
Mm-hmm. And they're newer? More sophisticated. Are you worried about them?
No.
No. Jeff, thanks very much for the call. Let's go next to David in Appleton. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi. Could you, in 30 seconds, give me a quick primer on nuclear reactors, how they work, how they generate power, what are fuel rods, and all these things? News stations aren't doing a really good job on TV of explaining how this all works.
And we'll even give you more than 30 seconds.
Well, actually, it's very simple. The uranium fuel rods, you have a chain reaction that generates a lot of heat. The heat turns water into steam. The steam turns a turbine. The only difference between a nuclear power plant and a coal-fired power plant is where you get the heat to turn the steam turbine. In a coal-fired power plant, the turbine's powered by coal. In a nuclear power plant, the turbine's powered by uranium, but the end product's the same. You get a turbine powered by steam that's generating electricity.
All right.
That's the only difference. The fuel rods are pellets of uranium that go into this reactor containment vessel. The water goes in, turned into steam, and run through a turbine.
Clark in Milwaukee. Hi.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Actually, I was Jeff, the first caller. I was concerned about that power plant as well in Diablo Canyon, I think it is. I actually own some property up there, and we're building a house, and we're retiring to that area. And the concern I had about, and I think this goes back 30 or plus years when this was first brought to light, this plant that is very close to a fault line. So, yeah, I'm wondering, in light of all of this, what's going on in Japan, whether these plants that are located in these areas are going to be looked at again. And,
okay.
Well, as I say, they're looking at them constantly, and they're not finding anything new to make them any more concerned than they have been in the past. So I don't see any fresh concerns.
Thomas, as you report on this story this week and beyond, what signs are you looking for that things are going to be okay? What stories, well, a couple questions. What stories are catching you by surprise here because we just didn't know that this was going to happen? And what are you looking for to assure yourself and the world that things will be okay as much
as
possible?
Well, I've been kind of skeptical all along that, you know, when they've always been talking about partial meltdowns, and to me that's been a little dubious because I think what's really happened, at least initially, was just some damage to the fuel rods that hasn't really involved a meltdown. But as the thing has progressed and they've started seeing things getting into the environment, and it's becoming more severe than I had expected. And as we keep seeing radiation release, then it surprises me that it's been released for so long. And what I would like to see is the levels of radiation release remain low. And as long as that stays, you know, as long as the levels release stay fairly low, I'll be confident that nothing severe is going to happen.
Uh-huh.
If the levels start growing, then we'll start getting more concerned.
And do you believe that we're getting accurate readings of those levels? The other thing that we're hearing is that the levels are varying quite a bit from place to place.
Well, I suspect that's because what's happening is they're venting steam from the reactors periodically. So every time they vent steam, you're getting a small burst of radioactive gas. And so you're getting a plume of gas that's probably spreading with the wind, and that's what's accounting for the rising and falling levels here and there as this plume spreads, you know, with the wind. So I'm not too concerned that, you know, the level varies. That's not surprising.
Mm-hmm. Thomas, thank you very much for being with us.
Okay. You're welcome.
Thomas Mo is a science writer for the Los Angeles Times and has also been 13 years at Science Magazine. He is a chemist, PhD in chemistry. We continue our conversation. Matthew McKinsey is joining us now, and Matthew is a senior scientist for the nuclear program, lands and wildlife program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. In the nuclear program, his main focus is on eliminating nuclear weapons and particularly finding solutions to the threats that have been posed by leftover Cold War arsenals in the United States and in Russia, and in getting a handle on the dangers of terrorism and the bomb. He has a PhD in experimental nuclear physics from the University of Pennsylvania. Our phone number remaining the same, and all your calls are welcome as well, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join the conversation. Matthew, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning.
Our last guest seemed to indicate that the next week is going to be crucial, that there would be a natural cooling off process if there isn't something unexpected that will take place, and things will be okay. We will be past the risk of a meltdown of this facility. Do you agree with that?
Oh, well, I agree that I really hope that things turn out okay. the nuclear fuel cools very slowly, unfortunately, and even the spent nuclear fuel that's on top of these reactors that has been involved in fires is still hot, even though it's been removed from the core for some time. So the cooling process is slow. There'll be a need to reassert control over the reactors and provide cooling, and that's got to happen soon.
Mm-hmm. And how slowly does that nuclear fuel cool? Are we talking weeks or months or how long?
Yeah, we're talking weeks to months when the fuel has to be cooled. So it's not a situation that is, in terms of the heat generated by the nuclear fuel, it's not a situation that's going to change dramatically.
And what is the situation with the workers who are working to cool those reactors with seawater, with whatever they can use to cool them? Are they doing a pretty good job? Or are these explosions in container, cracks in containers, hampering their efforts pretty fully? Or what's the truth there?
Oh, it's just incredible to think about the bravery of those workers
dealing with the
dangers of explosions and radiation. I mean, on March 14th, the radiation levels measured between reactor units 3 and 4 was 40 rem per hour. So that's potentially a lethal dose in just a 10-hour exposure period.
Mm.
So the workers are having to deal with only being able to work at parts of the facility for limited periods of time because of radiation exposure, constantly being concerned about hydrogen explosions, and desperately trying to get malfunctioning valves and other equipment to bring seawater to the cores.
Had anybody thought before this happened of putting seawater here, or is this kind of a Hail Mary pass?
It's a last-ditch attempt. It essentially makes the reactor unable to be used in the future to generate power. So it essentially destroys the reactor to do this.
I hate to have to ask this question, but considering the fact that everybody in the world is depending on those workers who are being exposed to very high levels of radiation, how much time do they have? How long will they be able to survive this?
Well, the health effects of radiation exposure are a function of two things. It's the intensity of the radiation, the dose per time, multiplied by the amount of time you spend in the area with radiation. So what the workers are likely doing is what was done at Chernobyl, in that they're being sent in shifts to work for a limited time in some of the most intensely radioactive areas.
Can you imagine doing that? I just had a picture in my mind of what you just described, and it kind of knocks you out, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's clear that workers are experiencing symptoms of radiation sickness.
Mm.
Even if you were at the boundary of the plant site for a couple of days, you would experience nausea, vomiting, some of the initial signs of radiation sickness. So they're coping with a lot.
They sure are. Let's go back to phone calls. We have so many who would like to speak with you. Rebecca in Madison is next. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi. Thanks for taking my phone call.
Mm-hmm.
I have just wondered about the confidence that we have in our nuclear power plants. I just want to comment about the culture of Japan. Japan is a much more prepared society when it comes to disasters than we are. And Japan, in general, is a culture that grows up focusing on sacrifice and community, et cetera. And just wondered if the speaker could comment on that. You were commenting how the workers are doing so much, and the whole world is relying on them. Do we have that confidence in knowing that we are as prepared and willing to sacrifice that much if we do have an earthquake in California or somewhere else where we are earthquake prone and have nuclear reactors? And I'll take a comment.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, after the Chernobyl accident in 1986, U.S. nuclear power industry argued that, you know, this was a very different design of reactor, a different you know, safety culture, a different organizational system that was in place to deal with safety and disaster preparedness. But here we're faced with a situation where there are just a lot of analogies between not just the organizational safety culture in the U.S. and Japan, but even the same kind of reactor design. There are over two dozen reactors in the United States that are really quite similar to the ones at Fukushima Daiichi, and also the fact that we do have reactors in seismically active areas. So the safety culture issue is important. In the U.S., the safety culture is strong at nuclear power plants. But in Japan, what you saw was a 1-2 punch of the earthquake and tsunami. It led to a station blackout. It was a crisis beyond what was planned for. And, you know, in terms of things like how much battery backup generation exists, at Fukushima Daiichi, there were 8-hour battery backup. At U.S. plants, there's typically a 4-hour battery backup. So there's going to be a lot of scrutiny of what kind of disaster preparedness exists in the U.S. for you know, the inconceivable.
The plant that's 40 years old in Japan, our last guest was saying that they had not prepared, which is hard to believe because it's right on the coast, for a tsunami. So does that indicate that the plant itself, if it had been stronger, would have been okay? When you talk about those two dozen plants in the United States, A, are they as old, and B, have people thought about the possibility of earthquakes and tsunamis?
Yeah, the six reactor units at Fukushima Daiichi, the first one, Unit 1, was built in 1970, and the last one, Unit 6, was built in 1979. So these are older units. In terms of disaster preparedness, I mean, the effects of the tsunami were essentially to drown the backup diesel generators that kept the cooling going. So, you know, again, this is a kind of catastrophe that is called beyond design basis. This is not a catastrophe that is prepared for or assessed in terms of licensing a nuclear plant, and you know, there are aspects of this that have to carry over for future U.S. licensing. Combinations of natural disasters, incidents of terrorism, and one thing that strikes me as particularly alarming about the Japanese incident is the involvement of these spent nuclear fuel pools. So not only do you have the fuel in the reactor, but you have fuel that's been discharged from the reactor sitting on top that could also be involved in explosions and fires. And right now in the United States, there are 60,000 tons of spent nuclear fuel stored next to reactors. In fact, the state that has the most spent fuel stored next to reactors is just south of Wisconsin in Illinois.
It is. We'll talk about that the second hour of the show. And in terms of these spent nuclear fuel pools, what has Japan done? What plans did they have for – did they plan to just sort of keep those there forever? Have those spent nuclear pool areas have they been there for years and years and years?
They have been there for years and years and years. The strategy in terms of – Japan's strategy on dealing with spent fuel is different from that in the United States. In the United States, the big game plan is to develop what's called a geologic repository, a deep underground storage location free from water in which the spent fuel can be stored over many millennia and as it slowly decays. Japan, on the other hand, reprocesses spent fuel, extracts plutonium. Oh. And creates fuel called mixed oxide fuel, which is actually loaded in some of the reactors at Fukushima Daiichi and could contribute to an even higher radiation dose if the accident progresses in a more dangerous direction. Yeah. Still,
Matt in La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I had a couple of comments. The first one is that, you know, Japan is incredibly invested in nuclear power, and it seems like what's coming out of the Japanese government and the American media is really that this is not that big of a deal. And I'm really shocked by it. You know, we're hearing things all over American media about how Oh, there's radiation and everything. There's radiation all over the place. Your last guest, it seemed like he was trying to say, oh, this will be okay when. And the truth about the matter really is that the whole entire nuclear fuel cycle is not okay. It's not just what happens at the nuclear reactor, but the entire nuclear fuel cycle. It's the one thing that produces the most CFCs in the entire country. It's exempted from the ban on CFCs. The enrichment of uranium produces millions of tons of equivalent greenhouse gases that's put into the atmosphere every year. It's an entirely racist process. Almost all uranium is mined on indigenous people's land. And it's incredibly dangerous, throws off radiation at almost every point in the whole process of making the uranium. It leads to things like depleted uranium, which I think your guest should probably talk about, especially since he does work on nuclear weapons. And it's an incredibly costly process that costs the taxpayer money.
All right, let's get a response. Matthew.
Well, those are very good points. In a nutshell, at the NRDC, we feel that there are three unresolved problems with nuclear power. And despite the disaster at Japan, I would still rank order them as follows. First is the proliferation of nuclear weapons, the problem that nuclear power technology and nuclear weapons technology have so many overlaps, and that's really unresolved still, as you can see in Iran and North Korea. The second issue is safety. And then I would put the third issue as the unresolved problem of what to do with all the nuclear waste being generated. Nuclear power accounts for about 10% of electricity production in the world. It's about 30% in Japan, 20% in the United States. The growth of the nuclear industry has been pretty flat since Chernobyl. Where it's anticipated there's going to be a lot of growth is in developing countries, especially China and India. And there, this comes back to the question of a safety culture. Can a very rapid growth in nuclear power in China be attendant with a rapid growth in the safety culture? But there are many environmental consequences of the nuclear industry, as the caller noted.
We seem to, in the world, and certainly in the United States, have made the decision that it's pretty darn safe and that we need this, and other forms of energy are problematic as well. A couple questions. One is, did we make the right decision in this area? And two, do we need to reexamine that decision?
Well, right now the economics really don't favor nuclear power. If they did, there would be more of a movement in the United States to build nuclear reactors. Right now, the government has to provide huge incentives to try and generate a few new nuclear power plant projects. There is an argument that you see in the media reporting on the Japanese accident that nuclear power is essential to mitigate climate change. And I would disagree with that statement. In our view, the most rapid and cost-effective way to reduce carbon emissions is to invest in renewable energy generation and in energy efficiency.
Let's go next. Thank you very much for the call. Let's go to an email. This one is, wait a second, I got to move this so I can read it, from John in Milwaukee, who says he's read about a new nuclear technology called pebble bed reactors. Radioactive material stored as relatively small spheres, self-contained with a ceramic coating. It sounds like this type of nuclear technology would be much less susceptible to earthquake damage. Are there any working pebble bed reactors in the field?
This is a pretty new technology. I agree with the correspondent. The technology that was involved in the Japanese disaster is boiling water reactor. It's the second most common type of reactor in the world currently. The most common type of reactor is the pressurized water reactor, and in that design of reactor, the core is just entombed in more concrete and steel than in the boiling water reactor. There are a number of new nuclear reactor technologies that are being considered, the small modular reactor in the United States. I mean, it's hard to rank order them in terms of robustness with respect to a catastrophic incident like an earthquake followed by a tsunami. But, you know, all of this is going to have to be looked at mm-hmm. more closely based on the experience here.
Steele in Menasha, hi.
Yes, good morning, everyone.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm curious. The previous guest, the last half hour, was talking about minor cracks, and I've worked in aviation, and even a light nick or scratch can cause the propagation of cracks. And with the thermal changes in temperature, what does that have to do? And then cooling ponds are where we keep the spent rods. Are they covered? And I had heard, you know, usually just maybe aluminum roofs, or some just completely open. And between laughing and crying, 30 years ago, the Carol Burnett show, there was a nuclear water spill, and so she walks into this room with all these red lights with a mop and bucket and happily cleans up the mess. Thank you.
In terms of the spent fuel pools, there are four of them in Fukushima Daiichi units 1 through 4. They're located on top of the reactors, and it appears that in unit 4, where there have been two fires so far involving the spent fuel pool, they're pretty much the spent fuel is pretty much exposed to the environment. So this practice of storing spent fuel next to reactors in pools or has been criticized by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's been identified as a problem by the National Academies. It really is an issue that needs to be addressed now that we've seen an accident involving a spent fuel pool.
We go to Paul in Duluth. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Most of my questions have been answered here. But a couple of things. First of all, if my understanding is now that they've had to inject seawater into these plants, apparently they will never be reactivated because of corrosion. So that's one point. The second point is I remember vividly the Chernobyl accident where there was no containment dome, pilots flying heavy lift helicopters had to literally fly concrete and dump it over the to contain the core, and they called it a sarcophagus. And if you want a definition of real heroism, those pilots were pretty much condemned to death by radiation poisoning.
Yeah, Matthew.
Yes, the caller is absolutely right. And in fact, news reporting today indicated that helicopters trying to dump seawater on the reactors were sent away without without success because of the radiation levels in steam and gases being emitted reactor.
Before you go on,
in terms of comparing this with Three Mile Island and Chernobyl, on the International Nuclear Event Scale, which is it's a logarithmic scale similar to the one that identifies seismic events, I mean, the Fukushima Daiichi accident is a 6 now. It's a serious accident. It's between a 5. It's 10 times worse than a 5, which is Three Mile Island, and still considered to be 10 times less than Chernobyl, which is a 7, a major accident with a major release of radiation.
Well, those helicopters are going to have to come back hours from now or tomorrow, right? Because they have to do that to cool the reactor, don't they, with the seawater?
Yeah, they'll have to continue attempting to cool with, you know, by dumping from helicopter, by using fire hoses, pumping, you know, whatever is possible. I mean, the fuel is not going to cool significantly for quite a while yet on its own.
Matthew McKenzie is our guest, senior scientist in the National Resources Defense Council. He has a doctorate in experimental nuclear physics from the University of Pennsylvania. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, we will be speaking with Democratic State Senator John Erpenbach and Republican State Representative Gary Bies. And we will be looking at, well, everybody's back in the state now. Are there any issues that there can be cooperation on, bipartisanship? And what about this constant cycle now of TV ads? Are we going to see this just forever, just sort of a part of our Wisconsin media landscape? How do we address the issues that are important to Wisconsin now, considering all that's happened? That's the big question of next hour. Let's go back to phone calls. Matt is next from Madison. Hi, Matt.
Good morning. I would like the scientist to comment on the explosion at reactor number 3. Since reactor number 3 was unique among them, it contained MOX fuel, which has 7% plutonium as part of the makeup. And with the explosion at reactor 3, and since the spent fuel rods were stored above the reactor, don't we now have plutonium that was released into the environment?
Yeah, the explosion at Unit 3 was the second hydrogen explosion at the Fukushima Daiichi plant, which happened on March 14th. The plutonium is produced in regular uranium nuclear reactor fuel as a byproduct of the fission process that generates the heat. So normally spent fuel will also have plutonium content. The introduction of MOX fuel into Unit 3, it complicates things with respect to the worst accident scenarios envisioned, in the sense that the radiation releases, particularly closer to the reactor, could be higher. And it could involve, obviously, more plutonium.
What questions do you want answered?
It's frustrating for me to follow this disaster. There really has been conflicting information and sketchy information coming out of Japan. During the Three Mile Island accident, I was actually a child at the time, and my family had to evacuate because of that accident.
Really?
The federal government provided daily substantive briefings, with technical details on what was going on in the reactor and the process of mitigating the accident. We're not seeing that in Japan. I mean, obviously, the country is dealing with a wider crisis, and that might. And of course, that impacts what the government can do. Still, I would like more information about what's going on. Ultimately, I would like to understand more clearly what the radiation releases are over time, how many people were exposed. The media reported radiation levels in Tokyo increased to a peak value around 10 a.m. yesterday when winds were blowing from the reactor towards Tokyo. I mean, that there's a lot of data that needs to be collected and understood in terms of health exposure, environmental contamination, as well as the technical details of what happened in the reactor and what lessons could be learned.
Mm-hmm. So obviously Three Mile Island determined the course of your life in some ways, doesn't it?
It did have an impact on me. My personal experience was that my parents didn't believe that we should evacuate until it was quite late in the incident, and we woke up and realized that all our neighbors were gone. So that was sort of a chilling moment when we piled in the car and drove through our empty neighborhood.
Oh, my. Well, let's take one more phone call. We have to do it quickly. Tom on the road. Hi.
Hi, I'll be real quick about this. My one big question is why they have always used water to cool these nuclear reactors. I mean, is this the best technology? Do they have to kind of cool these reactors down gradually during normal operations? Why can't we use something like liquid nitrogen or something with a real cold temperature?
Okay, let's hold it there 20 seconds.
Very quickly, in a boiling water reactor, the steam from the boiling water directly powers the generators. There are limited options in terms of the cooling for that reactor design. In general, you know, some different cooling materials have been explored, and some reactors, experimental ones, use different cooling materials.
Thank you, Tom, for the call. Matthew, thank you so much for being
with
us. Our guest, Matthew McKenzie, this part of the program, senior scientist, nuclear program at the Natural Resources Defense Council. That was pretty dramatic news that he lived through Three Mile Island. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. Thanks to Thomas Mao as well from the LA Times. And for all your calls, I'm sorry we didn't get to all your emails. There's just profound interest and lots of interest in this. We'll hear the latest news and return with more conversation.